Mr. Olbert, my first question to you is, why was this case tried in the Northern District of Indiana?
Because that is where the plaintiffs filed it. This case was first, case was filed in the Lake Circuit or Superior Court, I don't recall which. I think it was Superior Court.
Sure. Yeah, well, I'm not going, not sure much help I'm going to be. Mr. Overholt? Mr. Overholt, my first question to you is, why was this case tried in the Northern District of Indiana?
Because that is where the plaintiffs filed it. This case was first, case was filed in the Lake Circuit or Superior Court, I don't recall which. I think it was Superior Court. We removed it. The city tried to have the case moved down to the Southern District of Indiana. In a written opinion by Magistrate Springman, she denied the motion to change venue.
Why?
I think her determination rested upon a finding that was preferred venue, that because Discovery House had a location in Gary, Indiana, that the Hammond Division was the appropriate place for the case to be tried. This case involves several complex questions dealing with the scope of the ADA, the ability of a municipality to engage in adjudicative decision-making, and questions under Title II regarding standing. However, this court need not address those questions because there are two more straightforward issues here that are dispositive. One deals with whether there was sufficient evidence of discriminatory intent, and the second, whether the district court had subject matter jurisdiction to entertain this action. First, as to intentional discrimination, it is beyond dispute that under any of the claims advanced by the plaintiff under either the ADA, the Rehabilitation Act, or the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, they must show intentional discrimination against the city. That is, that the city was motivated by discriminatory animus to prevent them from opening their methadone clinic. Claim difficult to make since the city has actually permitted other methadone clinics.
That was another question I was going to ask. And what zoning classification were those other methadone clinics? You recall?
They were in a commercial district. The place where Discovery House wanted to open was, I believe, an HD2, which was a hospital or medical classification. The other two clinics, one of which was operated by the city of Indianapolis and Wishart Hospital, was in a commercial district. I believe that testimony is addressed in the record at the testimony of Maury Plombach, Volume 3, around page 186.
Thank you.
Now, plaintiff has not argued in this case that any of the factors from Village of Arlington Heights apply. And instead, Discovery House has chosen to rely upon two sets of testimony. First, the testimony of persons who testified before the board, and second, the testimony of the BZA board members themselves. Now, as to the testimony of the other persons who testified before the board, the plaintiff argues that because some of those speakers were motivated by discriminatory animus, as evidenced by their statements to the board, an improper motive of those speakers drove the board members to base their decision on improper motive. In essence, that the motives of some of the speakers before the board should be imputed to the board itself. Now, that is a remarkable claim that should greatly concern any jurist who is required to hear two sides of the case in order to reach a decision. As this court said in White versus Indiana Parole Board, listening to a point of view does not constitute bias. If it did, Judges could not listen to witnesses or lawyers who represent adversarial positions, and they probably could not consult with the authors of pre-sentence reports or read articles and law reviews, for both pre-sentence writers and professors may have access to Grind. That is exactly the danger that we face here. The board members in this case were adjudicative decision makers. They were empowered by law to sit and decide these kinds of questions for the Board of Zoning Appeals. They were required by statute, by law, to listen to the evidence, listen to both sides, and render a decision. To simply say that because some of the speakers who appeared before the board perhaps had improper motives, that should not be imputed to the board. Now, the question of whether one can impute to a board discriminatory motive because of the witnesses before the board is currently pending before the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Buckeye Community Hope versus City of Cuyahoga Falls. Exhibit number 10, which I implore this court to read, is the transcript of the actual BZA hearing itself. And it shows that Discovery House was one of 12 items on the agenda that evening for the Board of Zoning Appeals, and that Discovery House's session lasted approximately an hour. Again, that testimony, the transcript of the hearing, does show that some speakers before the board might have been driven by improper motive, but again, that cannot be imputed to the board itself. Now, the other set of evidence that Discovery House relies upon is testimony from the board members themselves. Plaintiff relies upon the testimony taken out of context, but I would agree, Your Honor, that there is some testimony from one of the board members that perhaps shows that that particular board member might have been listening and basing its decision upon what some of the speakers said. That was Isaac Randolph. The key testimony, I believe, from him is on page 228, lines 12 through 18. However, the others, at most, said they merely listened to the testimony presented to them, much of which relied upon the text of the ordinance. Several of the board members specifically said they relied upon the testimony of Dwayne O'Neill, a lawyer who represented at least one or perhaps two of the groups who appeared before the BZA that evening. And I would ask that the court please read the testimony of Dwayne O'Neill. That testimony is found on pages 2 through 5, page 26, page 33. That testimony talks about the merits of this case, that is, whether or not Discovery House was actually a medical clinic under the ordinance, the issue that was presented to the board. If one reads the testimony of the board members in full, paying particular attention to when they testified about their reasons for voting, you will see that discriminatory animus was not a motivating factor, at least as to four of the five board members. Because of that, there is a complete failure of Discovery House to prove discriminatory motive, and the judgment of the trial court must be reversed. Secondly, I want to take a few moments to discuss Rooker-Feldman. The question of whether this court lacks jurisdiction arises because the defendant in this case removed this case from the Lake Superior Court to the Federal District Court in Hammond. The city apparently removed the case, believing that subject matter jurisdiction existed. Upon further review and preparation of this appeal, it became apparent that this analysis failed to consider Rooker-Feldman. After Discovery House lost before the Board of Zoning Appeals, it filed a writ of certiorari. That writ is the appropriate procedural vehicle to challenge a decision by the Board of Zoning Appeals. It then went to the Marion Superior Court, where it raised three claims. First, that the BZA discriminated against individuals with disabilities and facilities that provide treatment under the ADA and Rehabilitation Act. Second, that it violated the Indiana and federal constitutions, particularly referring to the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution. And third, that it discriminated against public health facilities which distribute methadone as a treatment for an illness. The trial court entered judgment against Discovery House, which Discovery House then appealed to the Indiana Court of Appeals.
Was there an opinion written in that case?
In the Indiana Court of Appeals?
No, in the trial court.
No, there was not. Before the trial court entered judgment, Discovery House filed a lawsuit in federal court, that time in the Southern District, which attacked the state court judgment. Now, the district court ended up dismissing that case based on Younger abstention. Still unsatisfied, however, Discovery House filed a second collateral attack on the state court judgment while that judgment was still under review. This time, it filed it in Lake Superior Court. Now, because Discovery House filed the same ADA and Rehabilitation Act claims, the city then removed the case to federal court. The Rooker-Feldman Doctrine, as this court knows, deprives lower federal courts of jurisdiction to entertain collateral reviews of state court civil judgments or claims inextricably intertwined with a state court judgment. That doctrine prevented the trial court from obtaining jurisdiction over this case.
I don't understand the whole Rooker-Feldman argument here.
Let me see if I can...
Because the Indiana Court of Appeals ended up ruling in their favor. So how would the federal decision be contrary to that?
Because
the whole purpose of Rooker-Feldman is we're not reviewing the merits of state court judgments.
At the time Discovery House filed the action in this case, the one that ultimately got removed, the federal district court in Hammond, the trial court judgment was still standing. It was under review by the Indiana Court of Appeals, but it was still a standing judgment. Therefore,
well, wait a minute. If Discovery House would have lost in the Court of Appeals in Indiana, Indianapolis would have a great Rooker-Feldman argument here. I don't see how you have one here when they ultimately won. What would happen here that would be inconsistent with the result in, or would undermine the result in the state court proceedings?
Rooker-Feldman is a doctrine that prevents intrusions into state sovereignty. At the time this case was filed, and at the time it was removed, there was still a state court judgment against Discovery House. Therefore, at the time the case was removed...
We have to look at the last action of the state court, don't we?
Now, this court has to look at whether subject matter jurisdiction existed at the time the case was removed. Case law clearly states that subject matter jurisdiction can't be created after the fact. It must exist at the time the case was removed.
Rooker-Feldman doesn't deal with...
I'm sorry?
Rooker-Feldman's not dealing with subject matter jurisdiction. The federal court had jurisdiction to entertain this claim under the ADA. A defense to it by the state ordinarily is barred by Rooker-Feldman. You would be undoing the final results of a state court proceeding.
I question the assumption that Rooker-Feldman is not jurisdictional. My understanding of Rooker-Feldman is that it does go to subject matter jurisdiction, and that if this is an attack on a trial court judgment, which it is, the claims that were asserted on appeal to the Indiana Court of Appeals, the claims that were asserted in the writ of certiorari to the Marion Superior Court, were exactly the same claims that were raised in this case. It was a direct attack on the trial court's judgment, a trial court judgment that stood at the time this case was removed. Therefore, Rooker-Feldman applies, and this court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. The additional questions of scope and standing under Title II, I will address only briefly. First, as to scope, The ADA does not, the ADA is designed to prevent discrimination in program, services, or activities of a governmental entity. It is silent as to whether or not it applies to adjudicative decision-making by a board of this type. It is the position of the City of Indianapolis that the ADA should not reach into adjudicative decision-making by boards such as this. To allow it to do so, to allow the ADA to interfere or intercede and reach into that adjudicative decision-making process would be an intrusion far beyond what Congress intended when it passed the ADA. Actually, with that, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Overholt. Mr. Jensen?
Morning, may it please the court. I'm David Jensen. I'm one of the attorneys for the Appalee Discovery House. We had a jury trial. That jury heard evidence, and we received a verdict in our favor. As a result, the job of this court is not to reweigh the evidence with regard to whether or not we proved intentional discrimination. But let me make clear that the evidence in this case is undisputed that there is no factual or legal basis for the action that was taken by the BZA. And that was established by stipulation of the parties read by the court at the outset of this case. The court told the jury that the Indiana Court of Appeals had determined that the action of the BZA in this case was contrary to law. And the court further told the jury that a methadone treatment facility such as that our client proposed to operate is a permitted use in the HD2 district. That evidence was not only uncontradicted, it was stipulated to by the city. Each of the employees of the city employed by their Department of Metropolitan Development who testified in this case, Edward Mitros, J. June Duggan, and Maury Plumbeck all testified that the ordinance involved clearly provided as a matter of right that my client's methadone treatment facility was a permitted use. They said that not only in testimony, but they said it in their own letters to my client, letters to people who objected, and in their own internal memoranda that was submitted to the members of the BZA. In that context, then, what was the explanation presented to the jury that this did not constitute intentional discrimination in violation of rights guaranteed by the Rehabilitation Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and 42 U.S.C. 1983. Not one piece of evidence was offered by the defendant in this case. Not one. Indeed, the only witness on the entire issue that the defendant brought to the courtroom was Mr. Plumbeck. And Mr. Plumbeck testified without equivocation on cross-examination that not only did he concur in the decision made by his subordinate, Mr. Mitros, that this was a permitted use as of right, and he concurred in the decision of his superior, J. June Duggan, that this was a permitted use as of right, but that everyone else in the department, including the lawyer, Steve Neal, concurred that this was a permitted use as of right. In other words, there was no argument, there was no argument that could be proffered by the city that there was any basis in law or in fact for what had taken place. The internal memorandum, which is Exhibit 5, that was submitted to the members of the BZA, prepared en masse by the members of the DMD, specifically said that my client's proposed methadone clinic was permitted as of right, and it was ignored by the BZA. So the issue...
How do you prove, Mr. Jensen, animus by a board such as this?
Well, the first one is, do you have a principled explanation? And the jury was instructed with regard to this. And there was no explanation that any of the board members could offer. Isaac Randolph, one of the board members, said to us, you would have to be deaf and dumb not to have your decision affected by all of those people in the hearing room, mad as the devil, that a methadone clinic was going to come in. So Mr. Randolph says it was a factor in his decision. The attitude of the public with regard to the way they conducted themselves at the hearing. Ms. Liptak and Ms. Dyson, two of the other members of the board, said, we were influenced by E. Duane O'Neill. E. Duane O'Neill was an attorney who spoke at the hearing. But Mr. O'Neill told us at the time of the hearing that the following had occurred. Methadone has no therapeutic value. Addicts resort...
Wait. This occurred, or she said?
No, he said this at the hearing, which is Exhibit 10, the verbatim transcript of E. Duane O'Neill, on whom Liptak and Dyson...
Yeah, I understand that. I
relied. Yes, he said that. Methadone has no therapeutic value. Addicts result, quote, overwhelmingly to crime. The Department of Metropolitan Development does not know what it is talking about, and a methadone treatment facility is not a clinic. He also showed photographs of a purported drug transaction, which he said had been made earlier that day at another methadone treatment facility in the city of Indianapolis. This is what Liptak and Dyson relied upon. One of the other members...
It was not, if in fact, as a matter of law, a matter of fact, a methadone treatment program is not a clinic, then it would not have fallen within the purview of the ordinance, would it?
The ordinance says for treatment of public health.
That's a clinic, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
So if it has no medical value, and they believe it does not have medical value, and they believe it is not a clinic, whether they believe it rightly or wrongly is not material to the issue of bias. It's a question of whether or not they believe it.
We have to assume that Mr. O'Neill believed what he was saying.
And we have to assume, do we not, then, that the people that heard him might also have acquired that same belief from him?
Well, but their own expert...
Yeah, I know, but that's a question of two different people testifying at different things.
That's correct.
Right.
But the jury heard that testimony, and they resolved it in favor of Discovery House and against...
And that is, they didn't believe the board members when they said they followed O'Neill's position as opposed to anybody else.
No, they could very well, but they heard all of O'Neill's comments were put in before the jury.
Right.
And O'Neill's comments included comments which constitute the worst kind of stereotyping, which is exactly what this court said.
But he also said that methadone was not a medical treatment. It was not, had no medical value, and there was not a medical clinic.
That's correct. That's wrong, as a matter of fact.
Well, he may be dead wrong, but that's what he said.
That's correct. And the jury then, in light of all of the evidence, which included the fact that what O'Neill said was dead wrong, that the Court of Appeals has determined that he was dead wrong, and the jury heard evidence of that, resolved that issue.
I have no doubt that he was dead wrong. My question was whether or not somebody listening to him would have to believe he was dead wrong as a matter of law, or they would be lying if they said they did believe him.
I think all we can safely say is that the explanation that they offered, that they relied on O'Neill, was number one, vague, because O'Neill said an awful lot of things.
He said a lot of things, odd things. Lawyers tend to do that occasionally, but go ahead.
Yes, sir. And some of them constituted, as many of the other comments did, exactly the stereotyping of people who receive this kind of treatment that this court has said has no place in these determinations, including determinations of zoning boards in the Oconomowoc case that was decided just 3 months ago. There, the BOZA of the city of Milwaukee rejected a residential facility that involved brain-damaged and disabled individuals. And much of the evidence that was put before the BOZA was very similar with regard to the type and kind of stereotyping to which my client was subjected at that hearing.
That wasn't a damaged case, though.
It was not. It was not.
You're arguing to support a million-dollar verdict against the city.
That's right.
Quite a different situation.
And I'm arguing, Judge Evans, a million-dollar verdict when the city didn't offer any evidence, no evidence, of its non-discriminatory intent. The only testimony in the case...
Did you know that the trial judge, before the Indiana Appellate Court took a bite on this case, that the trial judge had ruled in favor of the Board of Zoning Appeals, found that their action was proper?
There was a writ of certiorari to the Marion Superior Court, and that was reversed.
The question was the jury advised of the fact that the trial court had ruled in favor of it?
Yes.
If you will see...
I know there's a stipulation.
There's a stipulation to that effect, and it was read to the jury.
What is it? But...
That's correct. The jury was told.
The jury was told factually.
That's correct.
That's what happened.
That's correct.
In the stipulation.
That's correct. Just as they were told factually what the Court of Appeals did. So the jury had all of that information in front of them, and they still reached the conclusion that they did. Now, of course, we also have the problem with two other board members who really couldn't articulate a clear reason why they reached the conclusion that they did. And that, of course, then required them to apply the instruction that the court read. Instruction number 22. The law acknowledges various ways to prove intentional discrimination, including acknowledgement of discriminatory intent, suspicious timing, ambiguous oral or written statements, behavior or comments which prevent one to infer a discriminatory intent, evidence that similarly situated persons received systematically better treatment, and that the stated reasons for the adverse action are not worthy of belief.
Your opponent indicates there is a case on cert now to the Supreme Court. Do you think it has any bearing on this case? The case is on cert on the issue of intentional discrimination.
I don't think that on the facts of this case, that any case on intentional discrimination, given the overwhelming proof that we offered in the context of absolutely no evidence to the contrary, would be effective. The Village of Arlington Heights, the Supreme Court case that served as the basis for the court's instruction, certainly allows us to offer proof of intentional discrimination in any one of a number of ways. And the complete absence of any factual or legal basis in this case, plus the fact that nobody from the city even mounted the witness stand to try to defend the decision that was made, certainly goes an awful long way given the deferential standard of review that this court has to utilize to support a jury verdict. After all, it isn't a question of whether or not this court would decide it differently. It's only whether or not there's a rational basis in the record for the conclusion that was reached.
How did this case again end up in the Northern District of Indiana instead of the Southern District?
It was filed locally in the Lake Circuit Court because Discovery House does, under Indiana Rule, Trial Rule 75, operate its business in Gary, Indiana. So that was a preferred venue consideration, and it was removed from there to the United States Federal District Court, the Hammond Division, by the defendant. And no error is cited with regard to that.
Well, I understand that, so that's not an issue. But I'm just curious why a zoning matter for the city of Indianapolis is tried in Hammond, Indiana.
That's how procedurally it ended up where
it ended
up.
Did Magistrate Judge Springman say that Indiana preferred venue control?
That's correct. Now let me talk briefly about the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. There was a good reason why it wasn't raised before, and that's because it hasn't any application. The source of the injury to the party must be a state court judgment from which the federal plaintiff seeks relief, because Rooker-Feldman implements 28 U.S.C. Section 1257, quote, final judgments rendered by the highest state court of a state may be reviewed by the Supreme Court and nobody else. As this court instructs, quote, Rooker-Feldman is based upon the recognition of the fact that inferior federal courts generally do not have the power to exercise appellate review of state court decisions, and that's Gary versus Giles. But we never asked any court to review a state court judgment in this case. Indeed, as this court tells us in Gas Associates versus the Village of Rosemont, the Rooker-Feldman doctrine asks, is the federal court plaintiff seeking to set aside a state judgment, or does he present some independent claim? And as we see in Gash, Gash was attacking the judgment itself. It has no claim independent of the state court's adverse decision. To put it differently, the injury of which Gash complains was caused by the judgment. But Discovery House does not and never has asserted an injury which is inextricably intertwined with a loss in state court, because it did not lose, and therefore nothing is inextricably intertwined with that loss. We're not asserting an injury at the hands of a state court, but at the hands of our adversary, a critical distinction which dooms Rooker-Feldman. We were also told in the brief that Rooker-Feldman applies to quasi-judicial determinations by administrative agencies such as the one involved here, the BZA. I'm sure that would come as a shock to the Oconomowoc Court, which dealt with the decisions of the BOZA of the City of Milwaukee or the Zoning Board of the Town of Wilmette in Dadian, both of which have dealt with zoning decisions recently, within the last 2 years, and both of which have applied the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act. But the simple fact of the matter is that this court has told us that Rooker-Feldman does not apply to administrative justice judgments, and if it's going to, it will have to be by the creation of the court that established it. Finally, the defendant relies upon Edwards versus Illinois Board of Admissions to the Bar, which is 261 Fed 3rd 723, as a basis for what he's contending in this case. But Edwards, as this court held, consistent with Feldman of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, holds that federal courts are without subject matter jurisdiction to review a final order of the state Supreme Court denying the particular applicant's admission to the state bar. That's exactly what was at issue in the Edwards case. The The court goes at some length to point out that the applicable rule, which is Illinois Supreme Court Rule 708, I believe it is E now, specifically provides that if the decision of the bar of admission is objected to, the applicant must file a petition with the Illinois Supreme Court. And it is that denial of the petition which caused the Edwards to come to the federal court and raise the claims that she did. That's the situation which, of course, does not obtain here at all. Now, this final argument that somehow or another the discretion that is vested in a Board of Zoning Appeals should not be subject to the reach of the federal courts under the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA finds absolutely no support anywhere. Indeed, the conclusion is just the opposite in this court, both in Oconomowoc only 3 months ago, in Dadian less than a year ago, but also in the Second Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit. It comports with the language of the statute, which does not provide for any exception with regard to these kinds of determinations. Simply stated, what the city wants to do is somehow to avoid having to live up to its responsibilities, just as every other public actor must, with regard to the implementation of the provisions of the Rehabilitation Act and the Disability Act. And let's not forget that in this case, the Rehabilitation Act and the Disability Act have detailed provisions to protect clients such as would be using this facility. The reason for it is they are dispossessed and they require treatment, and the statute is going to do absolutely everything they can to try to protect them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jens.
Mr. Overholt, how much time? You have 5 minutes, Mr. Overholt.
I find myself at an absolute loss to understand Discovery House's position before this court, that there is absolutely no evidence in the record regarding non-discriminatory reasons why the BZA ruled as it did. It baffles me. I would implore this court to read again the testimony of each one of the BZA members. Each one of them testified that they heard evidence, that they thought about what the definition of a clinic was under the ordinance, and tried to make a decision on that basis. Therefore, for, again, Discovery House to stand here and say there is no evidence, that's just completely wrong. Now, it's true this court has to give deference to the jury's decision, but also, as a court of appeal, it is required to see if there is sufficient evidence to support the decision. There is not. There is simply a lack of evidence showing discriminatory animus. I would specifically again invite the court to read the testimony of Dwayne O'Neill. Dwayne O'Neill, again, was the lawyer who testified on behalf of a couple of the community groups who talked about what the ordinance says, talked about what the ordinance meant. So there was evidence before the BZA about the issue that they were asked to decide, whether they met the classification under the ordinance. Now, what is interesting and what is lacking is any evidence from Discovery House at the hearing about what the ordinance meant. Nobody talked about the ordinance on behalf of Discovery House. Now, in their brief, Discovery House tries to say that somehow because people question the efficacy of methadone, because they questioned whether it was an actual treatment or instead was simply a substitution of one drug for another, whether it constituted treatment. Because they challenged that, somehow Discovery House seems to argue in its brief that that's discriminatory in itself. Well, that's wrong. Of course they can question it. People are allowed to come before the board and question the efficacy of treatment when trying to argue whether or not this fits the definition of a clinic under the ordinance. There's nothing discriminatory about that. And once you take that evidence away, there's nothing left. There is not evidence that three of the five board members, that a majority of the board members, based their decision on discriminatory animus. Without that critical link, Discovery House's claim fails.
Before you sit down, could you tell me about this claim of the exclusion of the trial court's decision upholding the board?
Yes.
They say it was covered in the stipulation. I know during the trial you try to get out from under a motion and ruling on a motion in limine that prohibited you from going into that.
Here's the problem. Under the 1983 claim, the defendant is required to show that, or plaintiffs are required to show there was no rational basis for the decision. It was our position that because the BZA and a trial court found that it did not meet the definition of a clinic under the ordinance, that that ruling was evidence that they should, that the jury should have heard, supporting the notion that it was rational. It is true there was a stipulation that was entered into that was read to the court saying that the trial court found the other way. However, if you read the closing argument that was presented by Discovery House, what they said again and again and again was how the Court of Appeals found that the decision was illegal, that it was contrary to law. But remember what the Court of Appeals based its decision on. It based it only on the meaning of the ordinance. It never found, it never addressed the question of discrimination, of whether it violated the RHA or Rehabilitation Act. I see my time is up.
It's not up. You've got another minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. The decision was important to be able to show rationality, to show that the jury that it could have found, in fact, that the decision was proper. Again, based on the evidence, based upon the testimony of the actual board members, this court should reverse the district court and enter judgment for the city. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Overholt. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.